This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. New whistleblower allegations rile House Democrats. Auto workers strike across the Midwest and the South. President Trump takes on California. And NPR loses one of its founding mothers. There's lots to discuss this hour on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us here in studio is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, a congressional correspondent with the New York Times. Cheryl, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you for having me, Joshua.
James Antle is editor-in-chief of the American Conservative Magazine and a former politics editor with the Washington Examiner. James, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, thanks for making time for us.
Sure. Thanks for having me back.
Politics is going to be the big block for the top of the show. We will talk about more than just politics, but there was a lot of politics to talk about, Cheryl, and I want to start with this whole whistleblower story, because that's moving as we speak. Can you, first of all, just give us the basics on this? It involves politics and Congress and the president and unnamed sources and possibly a foreign government. Can you just boil it down for like the 60-second basic kind of core of what this story is?
Okay, so here's what we know. We know that the Intelligence Community Inspector General is investigating some kind of unspecified complaint from a whistleblower involving President Trump and a foreign leader. We at the New York Times are reporting that it has to do with Ukraine. But after that, it's a lot of connect the dots. We know that the president has been pressing Ukraine to investigate corruption in that country and has sort of insinuated that Ukraine would have a better relationship with the United States if it would do so. We know that allies of the president, including Rudy Giuliani, have been pressing Ukraine to investigate one of the president's political rivals, Joe Biden, who was overseeing Ukraine policy as vice president when his own son was involved in some business dealings in Ukraine. So this kind of raises the specter of possibly some kind of quid pro quo, and that would go straight to the question of an impeachable offense. If the president, and let's make clear, we don't know this, but if the president was involved in some kind of trying to entice Ukraine to investigate Biden in exchange for more support for Ukraine, it could speak to things like high crimes and misdemeanors, and the Constitution specifically mentions bribery.
And can we speak at all, Cheryl, to how the Times kind of pegged it to Ukraine? Is there anything we can say about the sourcing?
I did not report that story. The sources were not identified in the Times beyond sources familiar with it.
Okay.
So the answer is no, I can't say anything about the sourcing. But I will say one other thing. There's a clash going on between Congress and the Inspector General. Congress wants the report. The acting director of national intelligence has apparently directed the inspector general not to give the report to Congress. So we're also seeing kind of a constitutional clash here.
Yeah, James, Congressman Adam Schiff of California, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, says he was not properly informed about the complaint, wants some answers. He talked about the complaint yesterday after meeting with the inspector general. Here's part of what Chairman Schiff had to say.
We do know that the Department of Justice has been involved in the decision to withhold that information from Congress. We do not know because we cannot get an answer to the question about whether the White House is also involved in preventing this information from coming to Congress. We do not have the complaint. We do not know whether the press reports are accurate or inaccurate about the contents of that complaint. But what I do know is this: if in a matter within the jurisdiction of the Director of National Intelligence, you have an employee of that community or a contractor or detailee who follows the law and makes a complaint, and it is possible for the subject of that complaint to essentially quash the complaint or keep it from Congress, then this system is badly broken.
That's Congressman Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, speaking yesterday. Jim, what do we know about kind of the back and forth of this? I mean, the president, I don't think, has said a lot about this week. There's just been a
right.
kind of a resounding no from the administration.
Right. I mean, President Trump tweeted out essentially that is his main platform for communicating to people. He tweeted out essentially a denial, or at least said that obviously, he wouldn't say something so dumb or inimical to American interests, especially with questionable people listening in to his conversation. So clearly that didn't happen. obviously Rudy Giuliani going on CNN and appearing to confirm aspects of what people are speculating about the contacts with Ukraine, but not quite confirm them, but sort of confirm them, really added some fuel to the fire. And there's been an overarching issue with congressional Democrats in their oversight of the administration requesting information from the executive branch and getting resistance to getting this information. And so this is just the latest example of that. And I think that given the state of the administration's relationship with leading congressional Democrats, including people like Jerrold Nadler on the House Judiciary Committee and Adam Schiff, there is going to be real pressure to get to the bottom of this.
The president tweeted just about an hour before we went on the air again about this whistleblower campaign kind of pushing back against the idea that there was anything wrong.
Right.
The president, in a two-tweet comment, wrote, quote, "The radical left Democrats and their fake news media partners, headed up again by little Adam Schiff and batting 0-for-21 against me, are at it again. They think I may have had a quote-unquote dicey conversation with a certain foreign leader based on a quote-unquote highly partisan whistleblower statement. Strange that with so many other people hearing or knowing of the perfectly fine and respectful conversation, that they would not have also come forward. Do you know the reason why they did not? Because there was nothing said wrong. It was pitch perfect," unquote. That's the tweet that the president sent about an hour ago. With regard to the pitch perfection of that, Anita, that kind of brings us to what Rudy Giuliani said last night on CNN in an interview with Chris Cuomo. We were going to play a cut, but I can just sum it up simply. Chris Cuomo asked Rudy Giuliani, did you do this thing that might have caused trouble with the president's comments with Ukraine, ask them to dig up dirt on Joe Biden? And Rudy Giuliani said no. And then about 4 seconds later, he essentially said that he did. What?
Right. Well, Rudy Giuliani often says one thing and then says another, much like the president does.
But this one's pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know. And he did not appear to think that that was a bad thing, right? That he was asking the Ukrainian government to investigate the president's political rivals. But we don't actually know if this has anything to do with that. I mean, there's a couple other things brewing here. The vice president spoke to the Ukrainian leader this week. The president's supposed to meet with him next week when he's at the UN General Assembly. So that raises some eyebrows there. And remember, it wasn't too long ago that Congress was worried and other people were worried that the administration was slow walking aid to Ukraine, military aid, financial aid to Ukraine. And we weren't really sure what was going on with that. And then the money went and the aid went. So there's a lot of different things going on with Ukraine, and it's a little bit unclear what this is about. The president, though, in his tweet, and he previously tweeted about this, is referring to something where most presidents don't have calls with foreign leaders that other people aren't listening to, right? On the foreign leader side, you have to assume that some of those aides are listening. And even with President Trump, other people are listening to those calls. They're in the room. They're off on speakerphone or some other kind of, line. So he's saying, well, people know what I said, and it was fine. But clearly someone thought there was some issue there and brought it to their attention.
James asked on our Facebook page, I thought the inspector general had discretion here, but the DNI was required to report to Congress. Am I mistaken? Is the DNI required to report this to Congress? Cheryl? I think that's part of the issue, right?
That's the question. What is the requirement? Is the DNI required to report to Congress? Obviously, Adam Schiff and other members of Congress are saying yes, and the DNI, or in this case, the acting DNI, is saying no, and we don't have a clear answer to that now.
It's a little different than if it was, say, the Secretary of Labor, like the Director of National Intelligence.
Yes.
Is this different? It's not. It's a different kind of office that like lives squarely within the purview of the presidency.
Yes, exactly. And also, let's not forget, this is not the Department of Labor. This is not the Department of Education. This is intelligence. This has to do with the most sensitive, secretive aspect of any administration, of any bureaucracy. And so, and we know that Congress is a leaky sieve, right? I mean, everyone knows that.
which is probably going to end up back in court again, like
right.
So many other things.
So, they... clearly they, you know, the administration wants to keep close hold on this.
With regards to what comes out of that leaky sieve, Sharon tweeted, "We're staring at an impeachable offense while Trump and his enablers try fervently to obstruct the House." Jim, I wonder what your thoughts are on this. I mean, asking a foreign government to dig up dirt on an American political candidate is a capital one no-no. However, There's also been the pushback, and Republicans made this case during the hearing, particularly with Corey Lewandowski, which we'll get to in a minute, that the Democrats are still looking for something. The Mueller report wasn't the smoking gun. They're still looking for a smoking gun, and they're praying, cross your fingers, that Rudy Giuliani's slip of the tongue last night will finally be the smoking gun.
Yeah, I think that this is another chapter in a sort of story of the Trump campaign and its interactions with foreign people, foreign governments, trying to find dirt on their political opponents, then accusing their political opponents of doing this very much the same. It's an interesting dynamic here because obviously if there's a quid pro quo, raises real problems for the president. But they also want to get this Hunter Biden and Joe Biden stuff out there, and it isn't out there to the same extent that some of Hillary Clinton scandals were.
We'll continue in just a moment with James Antle, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, and Anita Kumar. Also wanted to pay some homage to Rick Ocasek from The Cars, who died on Sunday. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
What happens when Ronald McDonald walks into a poor immigrant neighborhood in the south of France and sets off a supersized revolution? The story of how a company slogan to sell more shakes and burgers became a rallying cry for workers in France. That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, James Antle of the American Conservative Magazine, and Anita Kumar of Politico. Let's get to one more question about this whistleblower story, and then I want to move on to talk about Corey Lewandowski. Robert in Easton, Maryland asked, "What are the ramifications if either the whistleblower or the intelligence inspector general go public with the details?" Anita, I think that going public with national security information is a federal crime.
Right. I think it depends on what they're going public with, right? So if it's classified information, information that shouldn't be out in the public, that's an issue. If someone wants to bring something to the public's attention, they're allowed to do so. It's just the question of what that information is, and we just don't know. We don't know enough, I think.
Let's talk about Corey Lewandowski. He testified before the House Judiciary Committee impeachment hearings this week. Cheryl, I think this was the first, if not one of the first, actual like hearings related to the potential impeachment process. But this went sideways kind of from the beginning. Lewandowski was pugnacious, to say the least. He just didn't give a damn. He was going to make life hard for the Democrats from top to bottom and just kind of sit quietly while Republicans said, this is stupid. It's a fishing expedition. We don't really need to be here. Did we learn anything from this hearing, or was it just kind of like a few hours of Lewandowski, you know, sparring with Democrats?
I think we learned a little bit, not as much as Democrats would have liked to learn. Lewandowski did confirm the account that was in the Mueller report, in which President Trump had a conversation with Lewandowski to instruct Lewandowski to tell Jeff Sessions, the then attorney general, that he was going to limit the scope of the Mueller-Russia investigation. So Democrats were very eager to get that information out of Lewandowski because they believe that it establishes or goes a ways toward establishing that the president obstructed justice. But that's all they got out of him. Pugnacious is probably an understatement for the way Lewandowski treated members of Congress. There was one particularly nasty, I guess, exchange with Eric Swalwell, the California congressman who had been was running for president, and Lewandowski refused to read that the words from President Trump out loud. Swalwell said, "Are you ashamed?" He said, "I'm not ashamed." At one point, Lewandowski referred to Representative Swalwell as President Swalwell. So it was quite nasty. And Lewandowski was also under orders from Trump not to disclose any private conversations with the president. And he abided by those orders. He didn't, beyond confirming the account that was in the Mueller report.
So, Jim, was this a win for Corey Lewandowski? I mean, he went on CNN's New Day the next day and had a really rough interview with Allison Camerota and just right. kind of like bodied her live on national television and started asking her questions about, well, what about the press and what about this person and what about James Comey and right. why aren't you people? And it was a Twilight Zone episode really fast. Like, I think he knows there's nothing they can do to him.
Well, you have to remember that Corey Lewandowski has political aspirations himself. He is going to be running as a Republican for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire. There is precedent for this being a successful strategy in Republican politics. Pat Buchanan really became a national figure because he was very assertive and combative in his testimony to the House on Watergate, defending President Nixon. Oliver North played a similar role in the Iran-Contra hearings, defending President Reagan and himself and his own conduct in that scandal. And so Corey Lewandowski, I think, was taking a page from both of those gentlemen who really became pretty important conservative figures out of these kinds of confrontations with members of Congress. And with the Republican primary electorate, there is a premium for getting in fights with the media. I mean, Newt Gingrich won the South Carolina primary in 2012 largely because he yelled at a debate moderator during a debate, and it did not have much momentum prior to that. So these are things that I don't know that Lewandowski is going to be able to replicate the things that have been done in the past, and I think that Jeanne Shaheen is going to be a pretty tough person to beat, but certainly there's not a lot of downside.
Jeanne Shaheen, the incumbent in New Hampshire.
The incumbent in New Hampshire, a Democratic senator in New Hampshire. There's not a lot of downside to getting in a fight with Eric Swalwell or a CNN anchor in Republican politics right now.
Anita, we also learned this week that there is a newly named national security advisor to succeed John Bolton. Robert O'Brien was formerly chief hostage negotiator. The president named Mr. O'Brien the new national security advisor. His main order of business is dealing with the situation in Saudi Arabia and relations with Iran, and he has been critical in the past of the Iran nuclear deal. What else do we know about and expect from Robert O'Brien?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of an interesting pick. It doesn't differ all that much from John Bolton, the former national security advisor. He's not such a firebrand, though. I mean, he has those same conservative views, but he doesn't wear them on his sleeve. He doesn't have to insist that something is done his way. And I think what we're going to see is the difference is personality. The president says they get along very well. He seems, from all the reporting that's been done and people that know him, that he is more easygoing. He's not going to push his agenda. He's not going to push those policies. Even if he believes in them, he's going to be someone who is letting different people say what they think in a room and letting the president make a decision. And that's really what the president wants. And so that's what he was looking for.
Jim, let me come back to you for a second with regards sure. to a trip that President Trump took this week along the West Coast. Spent 3 days on the West Coast with a mix of campaign fundraising and attacks on California state policy. Now, while he was there, he threatened to revoke California's authority to set vehicle emission standards that are stricter than the federal government, those California emission standards. Right. He made that official on Thursday. California's Governor Gavin Newsom tweeted, quote, "See you in court," unquote. Now, Jim, the president froze the federal emission standards last year, the federal standards. In July, four major automakers signed a deal to comply with California's standards, which are stricter than the national.
Right.
What is the point of this? I don't know anyone who wants dirtier cars. Is this actually about auto emissions? Is this just politics because California is an easy political punching bag for President Trump? Like, what is this?
I mean, it's a little of both. I mean, obviously, President Trump believes that looser environmental regulations are in general better for economic growth and job creation, particularly in some of the manufacturing areas where he's trying to goose employment and where some of the swing voters who turn some typically blue states, red for him, are employed. But yes, some of this is obviously a political punching bag. Trump has no real chance in California. California was a major source of Hillary Clinton's lead in the national popular vote in 2016. It's not a state where he's really vying for their electoral votes. So I think going after Gavin Newsom, and before Gavin Newsom, he was going after Jerry Brown. Certainly, again, sort of like fighting with CNN and House Democrats investigating Trump-Russia stuff, there's not a lot of downside among Republican voters for picking these types of fights.
And a great place to fundraise. There's still some deep Republican and conservative pockets in California.
There are a lot of Republican donors in California. There are not quite so many Republican voters. Well, raw numbers, I guess there are a lot, but percentage-wise, not very many.
And Cheryl, while he was in California, the president said that the EPA would take action against San Francisco for pollution coming from the city's homeless population. Now, as a former San Franciscan, this is sensitive because homelessness in San Francisco is literally a humanitarian crisis. It is the most heartbreaking thing in the world to walk through this gorgeous city and see people literally doing their bodily functions on the sidewalk as you're making your way to the cable car platform. So this is not a joke. What's up with this?
You know, honestly, I think this was mystifying on so many levels. First of all, we know that this is frankly not a president who really is that interested in improving the environment. So let's say this was an environmental concern and not a humanitarian concern. President Trump wouldn't be the one to fix it. But what this really suggests to me is the president's way of looking at cities. He is not looking at homeless people as people who need to be cared for, as people who need to be uplifted. He's literally looking at them as trash that needs to be swept away. And he talks about, we can't let our cities go to hell. Isn't it terrible that people who go to work in our beautiful buildings have to step over homeless people? And I'm trying to sort of reserve judgment here, but it is somewhat mind-boggling.
Although, you know, it's funny, Anita, I have heard some of my friends back in San Francisco who are like, I really hate President Trump, but San Francisco's Board of Supervisors has not done enough on homelessness. So if this is the thing that shakes them up and makes them go, no, we'll handle this, then I might be inclined to listen.
I saw some of the reaction you're talking about where some people were saying, hey, we do need to do something, but they're not really sure they want this to be the way, right? They don't want it to be President Trump. But yes, I think you're right. I think you just cannot separate what is happening with the president with the politics of California, though. And we just mentioned it. Nancy Pelosi is, he's criticized her. San Francisco is part of her district. He has talked over and over about sort of fighting with California, and they've done it right back, right? The Attorney General of California has so many lawsuits against the federal government on a variety of things, including the environment and immigration. And I just think you can't separate the two.
And the Attorney General's predecessor, Kamala Harris, then went to the Senate and is now running for president.
Right.
John wrote on our Facebook page, attacking California plays well to Trump's base. Everyone knows what the San Francisco dog whistle means to them at this point. There was another story this week, and it revolved around something from the New York Times. So, Cheryl, let me come back to you. There were some Democratic presidential candidates who demanded that Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh be impeached in response to an allegation of sexual misconduct that the Times reported over the weekend. Before we get into the politics, could you just give us the summary of what the story reported?
So the story was actually an essay in our Week in Review section, our opinion section. So it wasn't a news article. It was written by two authors, Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly, who've written a book about Kavanaugh. And what they reported was that there was another allegation against Kavanaugh when he was a freshman at Yale, in which a woman accused him of exposing himself to her, and that this allegation came from classmates who had brought this information to members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, including Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Senator Coons received this information and wrote a letter to the FBI saying that he would like the FBI to interview, in particular, one former classmate of Kavanaugh's, someone named Max Steyer. And according to Coons, the FBI didn't pursue it. Now, I want to make clear that there are questions about whether or not that account has been corroborated. The woman in question did not talk to these authors. But nonetheless, there was a to-do over Chris Coons' letter to the FBI, which raised questions about the scope of the FBI's background investigation into Kavanaugh at the time that Kavanaugh was being accused by Christine Blasey Ford, a California professor, of having sexually assaulted Blasey Ford when they were in high school. And important to note, Kavanaugh has denied all of this.
Right, and sure, Republicans have seized on the notion that the woman involved in the alleged incident told friends that she doesn't recall it, right?
That's exactly right.
Jim, on Sunday morning, the president tweeted that Kavanaugh should, quote, start suing people or the Justice Department should come to his rescue, unquote. Two Democratic presidential candidates, Senators Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, have called for Kavanaugh's impeachment. Other Democrats walked away from that really quickly. What do you make of the politics around all of this, particularly the use of the I word?
Well, the emotions are still raw about the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation because people had very strong feelings on both sides of it. I think a lot of Democrats believe that Kavanaugh got away with what he did to with what he allegedly did to Blasey Ford and perhaps other incidents. And I think a lot of Republicans believe that he was falsely accused, that he was smeared, and that there continues to be a pattern of smearing him and making accusations against him with limited to non-existent corroboration and loose evidentiary standards. And so this was just another episode in that. And I think a lot of these perceptions existed without the need for a new allegation to be made. You know, there are still a lot of Democrats who are upset that he was confirmed despite the allegations, and a lot of Republicans who think that there was an attempt that narrowly averted to railroad Kavanaugh. So politically, I think there is some, when you have a lot of Democrats vying for progressive support in the primaries, there is going to be some kind of upside, I think, to taking a firm stand on this and using the latest reports to maybe reevaluate Kavanaugh, to get people debating and talking about Kavanaugh, to maybe even try to talk about impeaching Kavanaugh. I don't think that's going to go anywhere, but certainly it's something you can talk about when you're running for office in a Democratic primary.
We're going to move on and talk business in a minute, but Anita, this I word, the impeachment word, keeps coming up with this hearing at Corey Lewandowski, with this article about Brett Kavanaugh. And I don't know. I just wonder where politically that's going to go, where this thread of, like, it almost feels like, well, we got to impeach somebody. There's so much wrong going on. Like, we got to get somebody.
I don't know. You saw the Democrats say, we can't take this on about Kavanaugh. We're dealing with the president right now. We can't do too many things. I think they've sort of let that go. They're focused on the president of the United States now. There's arguing in the Democratic caucus about what they want to do and how far they want to go. But it's clear now that they're very much looking at a variety of investigations. And they are, you know, as the Democrats said this week, this was the Corey Lewandowski hearing was the first impeachment hearing, as they're saying.
And we've heard, like, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said, we don't want to think about impeachment. She's, you know, if anything, she would like to see the president imprisoned rather than impeached, or at least, defeated for re-election.
You know, the speaker has to think about all these political considerations, and there's so many vulnerable Democrats that don't want to hear that or have to vote on that. She knows there are not votes for this in the Senate. I mean, it's a very practical thing, even though some of her members don't really like that. But she feels like that they have to continue to investigate.
Season 28 of Dancing with the Stars is underway, including former White House press secretary Sean Spicer. He banged on bongos and twirled to the Spice Girls' 1997 hit Spice Up Your Life, dressed in a lime green ruffled shirt and white pants. After Labor Day, quel dommage, President Trump's critics denounced ABC not for the white pants, but for just having Sean Spicer on at all. They argue that that normalized someone who defended the president's lies and misstatements. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, the three judges scored his routine a 6, a 5, and a 5, total score of 16. Middle of the pack for the premiere, but far from the lowest score that night. We'll get to more of the week's top stories ahead. Stay close.
The
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. You've got big ideas for your business, but figuring out how to make them happen can be a real challenge. Well, the answer may be as simple as American Express Financing Solutions. They have over 4,000 specialists who can help find the right solution for your business. Chat with them today to see if you're eligible so you can get your plans up and running. The powerful backing of American Express. Don't do business without it. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/business.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please do take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so that other people can find the show too. Thanks.
Hey, you know what next year is, right? 2020, election year. The news is only going to get crazier. So join me, Sam Sanders, for a wrap-up of the week's news and culture that will not make you want to pull your hair out. Download and listen every weekend to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Cheryl Gay Stolberg, James Antle, and Anita Kumar. One story we're watching is the flooding in Houston, in and around Houston, caused by Tropical Depression Imelda. Some areas in southeastern Texas and along the Gulf Coast have been drenched with more than 3 feet of rain. That forced some chaotic evacuations and left a lot of people stranded. So far, local authorities have attributed 2 deaths to flooding caused by the storm. We're keeping an eye on this story with help from our 1A Across America partner station, Houston Public Media. Let's talk business. After one of the nation's big automakers watched its production grind to a standstill this week, 50,000 workers at General Motors walked off the job at facilities in 9 states on Monday morning. They want to end pay and benefit disparities between full-time and part-time or temp workers. Michigan Radio spoke to part-time GM employee Jesse Kelly. This is how Jesse described the working conditions.
They have a way of pitting you against a permanent employee where you feel like if you go the extra mile, if you work a little bit more than your union brother or sister, that will give you an opportunity to eventually get hired in full time. And that's not the case.
That's GM employee Jesse Kelly speaking to Michigan Radio. Anita Kumar, I wonder what your sense is of how big a deal this strike is.
It seems like a big deal. This is a lot of workers. It's a lot of workers. I was reading that, you know, they haven't been involved in a strike like this. We haven't seen something like this in a decade or more, probably since the last recession. So I think it is a big deal. And it's a big deal that some of these workers are, full-time permanent workers are siding with these temporary workers. I think that's a big deal also. But I think it's going to be more, I was hearing that people are sort of, this is resonating with people. A lot of times we talk about the economy and how well it's doing, and it is doing pretty well, but that there are a lot of people sort of left behind that aren't doing as well. And I think this resonates with those people that are saying, look, we still need other pay and benefits, and people aren't really realizing that when we keep hearing about how good the economy is doing.
With regards to it resonating, we heard from Sean, who wrote on our Facebook page, I work for Federal Mogul Powertrain in South Bend, Indiana. We are looking at a work shortage due to the auto worker strike. Some of us, myself included, have already been asked to not show up to work today. This strike affects more than just GM plants. I support the union workers, but am hopeful this will be over with ASAP. Cheryl, what about that? Is anyone kind of rising up to say, let me intervene in this, let me help resolve this, or is this still kind of very much in the hands of GM and United Auto Workers?
I think we're going to, we'll see whether or not anybody steps forward. But one thing that I've been thinking about with respect to the strike is that this strike kind of plays into this broader conversation that we're having in the country right now, political conversation that we're having over workers' rights, over the little guy versus the big corporation, over who benefits from, let's say, President Trump's tax cuts, over whether we should have a $15 minimum wage. You can see this strike sort of becoming part of the conversation that we'll have, let's say, when Elizabeth Warren or a Joe Biden or a Bernie Sanders is running against President Trump. And as Anita said, I think we're seeing a lot of upset in the country about workers. Yes, the economy is doing well, but people are still struggling in some of the swing states where the auto industry is prominent, states like Michigan and, also Ohio, these kind of factory states. And that's this strike, I think, is emblematic of of that.
I think you're right, Cheryl. And James, I think it is interesting that this is happening at a time when both President Trump and the various Democratic presidential hopefuls are trying to appeal to blue-collar workers. President Trump, because that's a part of his base, and Democrats, because they know that this is part of the demographic, this is part of the wave of voters who left them in 2016 and prevented Hillary Clinton from winning. So this really strikes at the heart of something that is super important to President Trump and to Democrats.
Yeah, and these may well be the voters who decide the 2020 election, given where they're distributed in the country. These are the swing states that are really in play. These are also the voters that the top-tier Democrats are really making an effort to reach. President Trump needs to retain his blue-collar support. He needs to cut into Democratic margins in union households if he's to be reelected. So it is pretty important. And also it does speak to something structural in the economy and the way we currently value work, that we're having a large-scale strike at a time where we have record low unemployment, at a time where we have, you know, fairly robust economic growth, maybe some signs of cooling, but the economy is doing relatively well, certainly better than it's done in a number of years. And we're still having a lot of conversations about, are people being justly compensated? You may be employed, you may have a job, but are you making enough money to make ends meet? And that's going to be an important discussion to have in 2020 and beyond.
Well, and Anita, to that point, I wonder if that means that because this is so important politically, that the president and the candidates are going to spend time kind of focusing on these workers, focusing on them, as opposed to helping them. Like, someone is gonna have to set politics aside for a minute and think policy if they want to get involved. But these voters are kind of a perfect photo op to show up at the picket line and show yourself shaking hands with and talking to voters, as opposed to saying, okay, let me put my campaign on hold for a second, let me put politics on hold for a second and get you back to work.
Hard to separate policy and politics.
For real.
I do think the Democrats are going to, you're going to be hearing them side with these workers and talk about these workers and talk about what this means. You know, the president hinted the other day that he could get involved in a different way. He's talking about maybe he could get involved and help solve this. He tends to say that a lot and sometimes gets involved and sometimes doesn't. So, you know, I do think we're going to see this, especially if it drags on even further. I mean, we're already into a week here and it really depends on how long this goes on.
Let's move on to another business story, because the markets were a little bumpy this week. There was a surge in short-term interest rates of up to 10% earlier this week, and then the Federal Reserve jumped in to try to calm the markets. Cheryl, talk about what happened with the Federal Reserve and kind of how the markets reacted to that.
Well, so the Fed decided to lower its interest rate by, I believe, a quarter of a point or so. And this is their concern, basically, about a softening economy. President Trump is pushing them to do more. And this, I think, is a very interesting clash between the president of the chairman of the Federal Reserve and the president. You don't often see a president take on the chairman of the Fed in public. But after Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, announced this, Trump basically accused him on Twitter of being weak-kneed. He tweeted, "Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve fail again. No guts, no sense, no vision. A terrible communicator." Trump wants them to lower the central bank rate to zero, I believe. And the Fed is, you know, not yet willing to do that.
Now, Jim, what's the president's case for lowering the Federal Reserve rate to zero? Why does he want to do that?
Well, he clearly wants to make sure that the economy is growing as rapidly as possible, and he thinks that any tightening of money, any rising of interest rates is going to be contrary to that goal. It's going to make the economy slow down, and he doesn't see any threat of inflation. It's really interesting because, number one, Powell is a Trump appointee, and two, Republicans have traditionally been sort of tight money people, not necessarily wanting high interest rates, but there's been resistance among a lot of conservatives under the Obama administration and before that to the idea that we should be pursuing growth through zero interest rates, through quantitative easing, through methods of growing the money supply like that. So this is a bit of a departure. And we saw Ronald Reagan sort of accept a lot of the tightening that was done by Paul Volcker, who was not a Reagan appointee when he was chairman of the Federal Reserve, even though it had short-term negative effects for the economy and helped raise unemployment at a time that was politically very bad for the president, President Reagan, because they lost the 1982 midterm elections because of a slowdown. Trump is not working in tandem with Powell here and is lobbying him to do more to goose economic growth.
Anita, one other business story that caught our attention this week had to do with Purdue Pharma, the company that makes OxyContin, owned by a very wealthy family called the Sackler family. On Sunday evening, this past Sunday, Purdue Pharma filed for bankruptcy, which caught a lot of people, which got a lot of people's attention because, of course, Purdue Pharma is trying to settle cases related to the opioid crisis. How does this bankruptcy filing affect things? It seems to blow everything into a completely different path of progress.
Right. And the company was asking this week the judge that's overseeing it to let them pay out money, salaries to employees that they felt did a good job or had done good work. And you saw a lot of people saying, well, wait a minute. What about all these families that are affected, all these lawsuits relating to OxyContin? So there is a lot going on there where people want the company to say, no, we're going to put these people first, all these different people across the country that were harmed. And so there's going to be some kind of fight. But, you know, the judge does oversee this. So it will we will see who ends up getting some of this money, whatever's left.
This week, we said goodbye to two legends of broadcast journalism. Soon after 1A launched, I had coffee with Cokie Roberts, one of NPR's founding mothers, and one of this program's first fans. She told me that even she was racing to keep up with this unprecedented political era. But she also made me feel more confident that this program could handle it. Cokie Roberts died on Tuesday after fighting breast cancer. Last fall, Roberts shared this guidance for young women in journalism during an interview with the Television Academy.
I would say what I do say to younger women all the time, which is duck and file. Meaning don't get all involved in the politics of your institution or in competition inside your institution or with other people. Just do your work and get it on the air. And then people will see that you're good, if you are.
That was Cokie Roberts in conversation with the Television Academy. She lived to be 75. Cheryl, I know you had thoughts on Cokie's life and her legacy.
Well, I do. First of all, Cokie was a real role model for women journalists in particular. She was a creature of Washington. Her parents, both her parents were members of Congress. Her mother succeeded her father. Her father was Hale Boggs, died in a plane crash. But I want to share this story, a more personal story of Cokie. A friend of mine whose husband died of leukemia recently had a small fundraiser at her home for cancer research. And Cokie was the featured speaker. And Cokie came, and she was already ill herself, but she came and she was so eloquent and elegant and wonderful. And Joshua, this fundraiser happened last week. It was, in retrospect, when I heard of Cokie's death, I realized this was such an incredible gesture on her part to do this. And I think it really speaks to the kind of woman that she was, and someone that I think all of Washington will miss her. America will miss her. Journalists will miss her.
Quite a few of you have also told us how much you will miss Cokie Roberts. Phil in Michigan emailed, I just want to say that I and everyone else that listens to Morning Edition will really miss Cokie Roberts. She was a walking history book. Every week, people would call in with political questions, everything from constitutional law to presidential history. She had the answer and was always very informative. And after she gave her comment, I came away feeling more educated. She will be missed. We also said goodbye to another journalist who helped cover some of the nation's political giants, including the Kennedys. Sander Van Oker of NBC News helped moderate television's first presidential debate between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon in 1960. He was also the very first TV reporter to interview Jackie Kennedy.
If it's not presumptuous, Mrs. Kennedy, what about your role as a mother and a wife? Can one have a role as First Lady? We haven't had a First Lady who's had young children for such a long time. Are you optimistic about fulfilling this role in the same way you did before?
Yes, I think it doesn't matter what else you do if you don't do that part well, if you fail your husband and your children. That really is the role which means the most to me, though obviously I have a deep sense of obligation for the others, but that's the one that comes first.
Sander Van Oker and Jackie Kennedy's very first TV interview. He died on Monday and lived to be 91. Mrs. Kennedy is actually very helpful for the kicker for me because Merriam-Webster released some new words for the dictionary, and there's one word in particular that I'd never heard before, but it applies to Jackie Kennedy. See if you can figure out what it means. The word is rhotic. R-H-O-T-I-C. Rhotic. It applies to Jackie Kennedy.
Are we guessing?
Mm-hmm.
Does it have something to do with her diction?
I'll give you a hint. You would have a non-rhotic dialect if you said things like "pak the ka in Havid Yad."
I was close.
You were pretty close.
To do with her diction, yes.
Exactly. A dialect of English is rhotic if it pronounces the letter R.
You must have already known that. How did you know that? Wow. I'm impressed.
I'm a good guesser. That was a rhotic and non-rhotic marriage is what we're saying.
Exactly. Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times. Cheryl, 10 points for getting the vocab test right, and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Joshua.
James Antle with American Conservative Magazine. James, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Anita Kumar of Politico. Anita, enjoy your weekend.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We leave you with the ending theme from the animated comedy The Boondocks. That show, based on Aaron Magruder's comic strips, took on tough topics like race and class and stereotypes. It ran to critical acclaim on Adult Swim, and this week it was announced that it would be coming back for a 2-season revival on the new streaming service, HBO Max. Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Christopher Castano. We will dive into the international section of the roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. For a change, this week's biggest international news is not just the sole domain of presidents and prime ministers, though we'll get to that. Millions of people from Sydney to Manila, from Dhaka to London and New York have taken to the streets to urge immediate action on climate change. There's also lots of news this week from the Middle East, Saudi Arabia under attack, Iran on the defensive. And is Israel facing a future that does not include Benjamin Netanyahu? Plenty of questions to answer in today's Friday News Roundup. Joining us in studio to help us with that are Rosalind Jordan, State and Specials Correspondent for Al Jazeera, State Department Correspondent. Rosalind, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Natan Gutman is Washington Correspondent for Israeli Public TV. Natan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Peter Bergen, CNN National Security Analyst, Vice President and Director of the International Security Program at New America, and the author of The United States of Jihad. Peter, good to have you back.
Thank you, Josh.
Let's begin in Saudi Arabia, where last Saturday morning, explosions rocked the Abqaiq Saudi oil processing plant, as well as an oil field to the south. U.S. satellite images showed at least 17 points of impact. Pentagon officials have reported that they have images of Iranian forces preparing for an attack in advance of the oil refinery airstrike, but they have yet to release that evidence. Peter, let me start with you. What do we know about the airstrikes at this point? Do we know anything for sure, or is it all still just kind of he said, she said?
I don't think it's he said, she said. I mean, look, the Houthi rebels, which are supported by Iran and Yemen, claim the attack. I don't put much credence in that. The Houthis have launched something like 200 drones and missiles into Saudi Arabia in the past several years. Most of those attacks have been totally ineffective. This attack was highly effective. Also, it seems from the satellite imagery that the missiles and drones that carried out the attack came from the northwest, not from the south. Well, the northwest is either Iraq, which has said that it didn't come from Iraq, or from Iran. And the administration says it's come from Iran. Now, the problem for the administration is when you've had a president say 12,000 falsehoods or things that aren't entirely true, according to the Washington Post, they're going to have a problem with making the case. And we saw with the Iraq War WMD case in 2003, that you can make a case which seems somewhat credible, and then it isn't. But in this case, who else has the capacity to do this? I mean, look at the attack. I've seen 17 missiles or drones, 25 missiles or drones. They flew at very low altitude. This is not some sort of ragtag militia. This is a state. And there are very few states with the capability and intent to carry this out. And the sanctions are really hurting the Iranians. And they are making the calculation that it can do something plausibly deniable that can really up the stakes for the United States and for the Saudis.
Well, to that point, Peter, you mentioned sanctions. The president announced new sanctions on Iran this Wednesday. Speaking today, this morning, about sanctions on Iran's national bank. Rosalind, here's part of what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said during a visit to meet this week with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. They were discussing next steps. And here's part of what Secretary Pompeo said about the airstrikes.
There were no Americans killed in this attack. But any time you have an act of war of this nature, there's always risk that that could happen.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking this week. An act of war, Rosalind, kind of, is that at odds with what the president said earlier this week? Is this an escalation? I mean, referring to a strike on another country as an act of war, a country we do a lot of business with, that's got to mean something.
Well, first, I think everyone who has been watching the Trump administration knows that the president will say one thing and his cabinet leaders will say something else. You know, that they contradict each other, that's not a surprise. What I think is interesting is that there is a 1951 mutual assured defense agreement between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Now, does this attack on Abu Qaiq and the Khurais oil fields rise to the level of being an attack that is an act of war? Does the U.S. now have a legal obligation to actually step in? But at the same time, let's recall the context of the past couple of weeks. The National Security Advisor, John Bolton, who was widely known to be someone with a taste for war, for conflict, was pushed out of the White House, mainly because the president himself said he didn't like being goaded into doing something that he didn't think would actually be useful and could possibly lead to civilian lives. There are people living around these oil fields and these processing plants. And so you do have the risk of civilian death if you did have some sort of attack to respond on Iran. That said, there is also the president looking toward the United Nations Security Council to try to build international pressure to add to the administration's maximum pressure campaign on Iran to change its behavior. The president campaigned back in 2016 on not getting into any more wars in the Middle East. And if he were to listen to his Secretary of State, who I might point out has dialed back his own rhetoric, we could already be in a war with Iran. But you do see the president trying to put the brakes on this, trying to focus on more diplomatic engagements rather than just immediately invoke the 1951 treaty and say, okay, we're going to put our forces in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf, on the very highest alert.
And Rosalind, just to clarify, is this 1951 deal between the U.S. and Saudi, or treaty between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, kind of the same spirit as that NATO Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all kind of thing, or is this different?
It's basically the same sort of thing, but what's important to note is that Saudi Arabia is not a major non-NATO ally, where you do have a higher expectation of response, the kind of response that the U.S. would be prepared to follow through on with Japan or with Israel or with South Korea. It doesn't have that kind, it has not given that status to Saudi Arabia. And so there's a question on whether the U.S. should be jumping that quickly.
Now, with regards to Iran's perspective on this, Natan, Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif also talked about the prospect of war. He was interviewed on CNN's New Day this week. It's part of what he said.
What would be the consequence of an American or Saudi military strike on Iran now?
An all-out war.
You make a very serious statement there, sir.
Well, I make a very serious statement about defending our country.
It was Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif being interviewed on CNN this week. How likely is military conflict? Calling it an act of war is one thing, but actually going to war, Natan, that's a whole other situation.
I think if there's one thing that we know about President Trump by now is that he's very averse to military action. He sees it as a last resort. He sees it as a waste of money. It definitely is averse to the idea of sending U.S. troops to the Middle East. We can even see that in the exchange that he had this week with Senator Lindsey Graham, who was basically saying, look, the Iranians don't get subtleties. They don't understand the sanctions that you're doing. It's not changing their behavior. You need to show military force. And Trump just went back and said, well, what about the Iraq war? Are you still proud of that? So basically, that's Trump's defining moment. The Iraq war, the billions that he sees that America, in his opinion, wasted in the Middle East. And for that cause, he sees the Middle East as everything from North Africa to Afghanistan. And that's why he's not likely to take military action. There's also another factor here. If Trump stopped the planes in the air before responding after a U.S. drone was shot down by the Iranians directly, it would be kind of hard to explain why you're responding now militarily when it's not the U.S. that's been attacked, but the Saudis.
Peter, with regards to what we know or don't know, a number of people on Twitter and Facebook have been asking what we know about the drones, particularly where they were made, the U.S., Russia, China, France. Do we know anything about the drones that were used in this attack?
I mean, there is circuit boards have been recovered at the site. I mean, there's an investigation that's going on. I think the Saudis have been pretty clear. Well, actually, the Saudis have been a little ambiguous about what they think happened. The United States has not. I just think in the universe of potential places this might have come from, it points to Iran. To make that a definitive, I mean, you know, we have the United Nations General Assembly next week. The Iranians may or may not get visas to get there, but every important kind of ally of the United States will be there. My guess is we'll have a pretty definitive sense that United States officials can explain. But you know, as I said earlier, it's highly unlikely that it's from Yemen. The rebels there just don't have the capability.
Mike emailed, "What evidence is there that Iran is not the source of this attack, Peter? If any."
Well, it's hard to prove negative,
Right, it's hard to prove a counterfactual, yeah. But nothing has emerged that would kind of rule out Iran. Say, oh, this isn't the kind of equipment they use.
I think that's right. I mean, look, the Iranians and the Saudis have been fighting a proxy war in the Middle East for many years. The heat just went up. You know, this is now a much more direct state-on-state conflict.
Well, and Roslyn, with regards to that heat, it's also affecting world oil prices, which surged on Monday, dropped again on Tuesday because the Saudis assured the world that oil production would get back to normal in a few weeks. This is not just some oil field. This is a critical part of the world's oil supply.
We're talking 5-6% of the global oil supply that comes from Abqaiq. And you might say, well, the United States is energy independent. That's still 5% of the world's oil supply, and the U.S. does rely on that. When the president says, I'm ready to tap into our strategic petroleum reserve in order to stabilize oil prices, then, you know, that is a concern. But that doesn't matter to the markets. Anytime there's something unpredictable happening, such as an interruption in international oil supplies, they're going to gin up the price. And there are already concerns that oil prices, gasoline prices here in the United States could go up 25 cents a gallon if this crisis isn't resolved quickly.
We've got some more details from the Treasury Department about the sanctions that were announced today. While I give Roslyn a chance to read through that a little bit longer, Peter, James wants to know if they are ragtag, why hasn't Saudi Arabia destroyed them? Maybe a little more clarity about who them is and about the nature of that force.
Yemen has been in various kinds of civil wars since the early 60s, and the Houthis are essentially Shia Zaidi group in the north. They are, you know, they're fighting on their own territory. The Saudis haven't put ground troops in. It's been an air war. You know, what both this attack on the Saudi oil facilities and the Yemeni war say about Saudi Arabia is pretty interesting. This is one of the world's largest importers of weaponry. Mohammed bin Salman, the effective leader of the country, is the defense minister. He was the guy who launched this very ineffective war in Yemen, which has created one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in the world, hasn't won against the Houthi rebels, who are lightly armed, supported by Iran. And then you have to ask yourself, how is it that their crown jewel, this Abqaiq oil facility, the most important facility they have, because their economy still remains totally dependent on oil, how did that get attacked and get taken out when they've spent all this money? And why is it that they've been so ineffective.
We should also be clear in terms of Saudi Arabia destroying them. I mean, Yemen and Saudi Arabia share a north-south border. Yemen is just south of the southwestern corner of Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia is not really at war with the rebels. Saudi Arabia is backing someone who's at war with the rebels.
Well, I mean, they're bombing them every day. I mean, they've killed, I mean, tens of thousands of civilians. I mean, they're supporting proxy forces on the ground in Yemen. They're also bombing from the air frequently.
Rosalind, could we get a little bit more detail on the sanctions that the Treasury Department announced today, particularly the rationale that has to do with some of Iran's fighting forces, like the Revolutionary Guard and so forth?
Okay, so basically, what the Trump administration has now done, it has now imposed sanctions under Executive Order 13224, which is a counterterrorism sanctions order, against the National Bank of Iran, against a sovereign wealth fund that has been processing revenues from the Iranian oil industry, as well as another private business, basically for sending billions of dollars to the IRGC, which is the elite paramilitary branch of the Iranian government. And it's a branch that is incredibly, incredibly powerful. Its affiliate is known as the Quds Force. It also supports Hezbollah, which is the group in southern Lebanon, which has been a destabilizing force in that country for decades. Now, what this sanction means is that all property, all assets that these three entities have here in the United States are now frozen. They cannot access those funds. It further basically outlaws U.S. persons, whether you're a citizen or a resident, from doing any business with the National Bank, with this sovereign wealth fund, and with this private company. Otherwise, you could find yourself in trouble with the U.S. Justice Department. If you're not a U.S. person, you could find yourself being sanctioned as well. People are asking, well, how is this any different from any other sanctions? Well, remember, earlier this year, the U.S. did something that had not been done before, which is it targeted an actual part of another country's government, which was the IRGC and, by extension, the Quds Force. To go after part of an operating government is really unprecedented. This simply expands the U.S.'s ability to continue what it calls its maximum pressure campaign. If the Iranians had argued before that the U.S. is trying to economically cripple this country, I would argue they have more of an argument to make. The Trump administration's view, I would submit, is that we have to stop Iran's malign behavior however we can. And if they're spending billions of dollars in order to go after our interests and those of our allies and partners, that's what we will do.
Now, Natan, zooming out, first of all, thank you for that context, Rosalind. Zooming out from that a little bit, we've got this maximum pressure campaign that has now kind of kicked up to a new level in this kind of unprecedented way. You've also got other nations that do business with Iran that are trying to kind of, mend fences is the wrong term, but trying to kind of calm things down, especially with the nuclear deal, nations that still do business with Iran, including for oil. Add to that, there's a new national security advisor here in the U.S. His name is Robert O'Brien. The president named him on Wednesday. Here's a quick clip of Mr. O'Brien speaking after that announcement.
We look forward to another year and a half of peace through strength. We've had tremendous foreign policy successes under President Trump's leadership. I expect those to continue.
O'Brien replaces John Bolton, who left last week, or who was forced out last week. What do we expect all this to mean going forward? John Bolton's out. There's a new guy, Mr. O'Brien. We've got these new tighter sanctions on Iran. Iran was one of John Bolton's, you know, it was the white whale for John Bolton in some ways. So what happens now?
Well, if we look at the reports leading up to John Bolton's resignation or firing, basically, the breaking point was this meeting at the White House in which President Trump spoke about easing some of the sanctions in order to facilitate a meeting with him and the Iranian President Rouhani. So definitely, Bolton was the force within the White House pushing for stronger sanctions and for a possible military action down the road. O'Brien, we know less about him. He definitely doesn't have the character of Bolton. He's not a single-issue guy. He's not focused on the Iranian issue, but he is probably as hawkish, though we should keep in mind that with a lower profile, he'll probably have less influence on the president than Bolton had. Basically, we're shifting the power probably towards Secretary Pompeo. who was previously an Iran hawk, but somehow managed to change his views after joining the Trump administration.
And John Bolton was also very vocal about his views on Iran and everything else. So it'll be interesting to see how much of a public persona Mr. O'Brien has compared to John Bolton. Let me stick with you, Natan, as we move away from Iran. And again, the story is just moving today. Keep an ear out on your NPR member station to npr.org in terms of the reaction from the administration, from Iran, from the international community. That's still playing out. So NPR News will have that story as the story materializes through the day. Another story that's materializing is in Israel and the power struggle after this week's election there. It could end Benjamin Netanyahu's run as Israel's longest-serving prime minister. Benny Gantz and his centrist party, the Blue and White Party, will come out of the election with more parliamentary seats than Netanyahu's party, the Likud Party. Netanyahu rejected the idea of forming a unity government with Blue and White through the campaign. Now he's lost that edge, says he's open to a coalition with Gantz. Gantz says that door has kind of closed. So, Natan, I'm not sure who the prime minister's going to be. Like, you would think, okay, we got two more seats than you, then we get to pick the prime minister, but it's a little more complex than that.
Yeah, it definitely is. And we won't know for a while who the next prime minister is going to be. Right now, we're at the very, very early stages of trying to feel out the situation and form future coalitions. The first step would be convincing the Israeli president, who usually holds only a formal position. One of his few roles is to choose the politician who will be tasked with forming the next government based on whoever has the best chances of doing so. So in the next week, we'll see him interviewing heads of all the parties that got into the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Some of them will recommend Netanyahu, some will recommend Gantz. And the president would have to make a decision there. It's a tough decision to make because none of them have the magic number of 61. So one of them will get this mandate to try and form a coalition. He'll have 42 days to do that. But it's hard to see anything happening within that time frame. It will probably have to wait for the next guy to get it. Basically, the forces going on here are reality will force a national unity government between Likud and Blue and White, maybe with Avigdor Lieberman, the secular, kind of hawkish former defense minister who seems to be holding the balance right now.
A lot of people have referred to him as kind of a kingmaker.
Right, he's a kingmaker right now. The only problem is that Gantz's party and Lieberman, for that matter, are conditioning any coalition with the Likud with the fact that Bibi needs to step down. An end to Netanyahu's era. He's facing criminal investigations, possible indictments very soon. A coalition with the Likud, but without Netanyahu. Right now, Netanyahu is holding on to his seat. His party is behind him. Just have to wait and see how long that holds.
The corruption charges could become official in like 2 weeks from now. Is that looking likely?
No, probably like a year from now.
Or a year from now.
The process of a hearing, which is the last stage before official indictments, is starting right now. But as we know, this can drag on for a while, probably a year.
Peter, I wonder what your sense is of what all this means for Israel in a larger sense. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu has, to say that he's loomed large over Israel is the ultimate understatement. Like, now that he's on his way out, possibly, you know, what do you think that this means for Israel in a larger sense?
Well, one thing I'm curious about is the Jared Kushner peace plan, which was delayed by their own account, till this election was over. Now, judging from Natan's comments, the election isn't over for a while because they're still kind of horse trading about who's actually going to become prime minister. But I'm waiting for bated breath to hear what the Kushner peace plan is, which really seems to be effectively the death knell of any kind of two-state solution. And they don't seem, it's like a, you know, there was this conference in Bahrain that Jared Kushner put together. No Palestinians showed up. You know, it seems that this thing has just crashed and burned. And it's interesting when you hear Robert O'Brien saying all the great successes of the Trump administration foreign policy. Well, as I count it, Israel-Palestine peace is dead. Chinese negotiations on trade are at an impasse. The Iran thing, pulling out of the deal, has created the situation we just talked about just now. You know, the U.S. trade with a Mexico deal is sort of stuck in Congress. I mean, this is not a record of huge accomplishment.
Do we have any sense, Rosalind, of what Benny Gantz might be like diplomatically compared to Netanyahu in terms of dealing with all these big issues, or is it kind of too soon to know?
It's too soon to know, but there's already been chatter about whether a two-state solution might yet survive. There are questions about whether he might actually bring in some of the political parties that represent Israeli Arabs and whether that would have an impact on the peace process. There is the question of the long-term relationship with Avigdor Lieberman, whom many in the West know. And it does affect how do they proceed in terms of trying to build future alliances with other countries in the Middle East. They have peace treaties with Jordan and with Egypt. There had been this tacit engagement with Gulf countries. Does that continue under a Benny Gantz relationship? There's this rubric that someone coming from the military is much more realistic about building these alliances with countries in the region than someone who's acting purely from ideology.
Before we move on from Israel, Natan, what's the mood like right now? I mean, you've got these corruption charges hanging over Netanyahu. You've got this parliamentary election that was too close to call for a while, and now it's still inconclusive. How are Israelis doing with all this?
Israelis are concerned and frankly annoyed by the political situation. It's the second election within 5 months. Once again, no conclusion. They didn't understand why they had to go to elections again just because Netanyahu couldn't form a coalition last time. The situation right now where nothing is clear even after the elections and after a very tough election campaign that drew out a lot of hate and a lot of anger, Israelis are annoyed at the system. Netanyahu isn't a very popular figure outside the Likud party. I think Israelis, what they would like to see more than anything else, is just for all this to be over. And that's why a national unity government could be a good solution, not only based on the electoral map, but also in terms of what the country needs now to somehow heal from this political divide.
Let's shift gears to Canada, where Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in the middle of a very intense re-election campaign that just got more complicated. Now he's in the midst of a scandal with a little more than a month to go before Election Day. Here is a clip of Justin Trudeau at a press conference addressing this scandal.
I have worked all my life to try and create opportunities for people to fight against racism and intolerance. And I can just stand here and say that I made a mistake when I was younger, and I wish I hadn't. I should have known better then, but I didn't, and I did it, and I am deeply sorry for it.
Rosalind Jordan, what was it that Justin Trudeau says he should have known better about when he was younger?
In 2001, anyone over the age of 10 should have known that putting on very dark brown makeup on one's skin and dressing up as a figure, a Latin apparently, just isn't done. And that is what he did. It has now come out that there have been at least three such instances of his wearing what they're calling in Canada brown face, what we in the U.S. would call blackface. It has called into question his commitment to multiculturalism. It has made some in Canada question whether he really is as progressive as he has built his political career on. There are other Canadians who say this is not happening in the same context as it would be if it were here in the United States because of the history of blackface as both an entertainment and a way of culturally denigrating African Americans starting in the mid-19th century. There are people who are willing to give him a chance, but this couldn't come at a worse time. He is up for re-election in several weeks' time. He was already dealing with a political corruption scandal involving the attempt to prosecute or not prosecute a major party funder in Montreal because of its bad behavior. And it was alleged that he had put pressure on the country's top prosecutor not to go after this company. So it's a real dent in his reputation. But again, this is Canada. They may be willing to give Justin Trudeau another chance to rehabilitate himself, whereas here in the U.S., we're very quick to say that person must go.
Yes, except perhaps in the case of Virginia's Ralph Northam, because he had a very similar political scandal, and
well,
he seems to have,
I think because he's not up for re-election, people have simply said, well, you know what, you can probably kiss the rest of your political career goodbye, but you can't run for re-election in Virginia anyway. It's one term and you're done.
Let's wrap up our conversation on Canada before we talk briefly about the UK. Rosalind, I wonder what your sense is of what happens now. And granted, this just happened a few days ago, but Justin Trudeau is very well liked in a lot of circles. What he did, what came out in these pictures, he has said he doesn't remember it, but he has owned it for the most part. It's clearly highly, highly, highly offensive, but I wonder what your sense is of whether he can overcome this scandal or if it sinks his re-election chances. Personally, I think that he can, but I don't know. This feels like it's so on the bubble, like something else will happen to tip the scale. But to me, it's leaning like he might survive this.
He might survive it. And again, I think it goes back to the question of context. You didn't have the same experience with racism in the U.S. that you had in Canada. I'm not Canadian, by the way, so I'm welcome to everyone's critique on what I'm about to say. But I think it is important to note that you have perhaps the largest English-speaking Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean community in Canada, outside of the region and outside of the UK proper, which had a very different experience with the slave trade and with independence. People look at these things in a very different way from the way that someone who is from the United States, whose ancestors were from the United States, look at these measures. So there could be a sense of, look, he has been doing all of this work on trying to improve equity for women, for trying to improve access for Blacks and other people of color, for trying to recognize the struggle of First Nations peoples in the country. We should give him a chance to redeem himself. However, because of that previous political corruption scandal that ended up with the Attorney General, I'm getting her title wrong, quitting, because she felt that she was being pressured by the prime minister and by his aides to not go hard on a key political donor. If something like that comes out, I think that is something that Canadians would hold more against him than this incident.
Thomas writes, "We in Canada use the term blackface to refer to dressing as African, and brownface refers to characters such as Aladdin or any South Asian." Let's keep moving. A few more stories I'd like to get to before we head out for the weekend. Let's move to Britain. The legal system there grew out of the Norman conquest back in the year 1066. Remember that? But Britain has only had a Supreme Court since 2009. And this week, that court faced probably its toughest test yet. It is considering whether Boris Johnson abused his powers as Prime Minister, whether he lied to the Queen about why he chose to suspend Parliament weeks before the country is due to leave the European Union. Peter Bergen, I'd like to get your sense of this. You've got Boris Johnson getting also some flack from former Conservative Prime Minister John Major. The president of the UK Supreme Court, Lady Hale, laid out a timetable for the final decision and was very clear that there's a lot at stake.
It is not a simple question, and we will now consider carefully all the arguments which are being presented to us. And we hope to be able to publish our decision early next week.
So you've got former Prime Minister John Major chiming in. Former Prime Minister David Cameron is also making his voice heard. Brexit is coming up. The UK's Parliament was suspended in a very noisy session of Parliament that made for some entertaining conversation last week. Where does this go from here?
Well, no one knows, including Boris Johnson. Look, I mean, David Cameron and Boris Johnson both went to Eton. They both went to Oxford. And they probably will go down in history as two of the worst prime ministers in the last century. Because it was David Cameron's brilliant idea to go to have this vote, which he thought the public would vote against Brexit, and that didn't happen. And the public didn't even really know what they were voting for. And then you have Boris Johnson, who's changed his mind 57 different times about this, who now says, you know, he's willing to take the country into a hard Brexit. Well, a hard Brexit would basically be one of the worst things that's happened to the English economy since the Great Depression. And right now we don't know. I mean, we have no idea what the outcome is. And of course, I'm very interested in exchange rates between the dollar and the pound as somebody who grew up in England and sometimes goes back there. And if you're an American citizen going to England right now, it is pretty good deal. It didn't used to be a good deal because the pound has lost about 20% of its value against the dollar since the Brexit. If we had a hard Brexit, it would lose about another 20%. So this is, One thing that we do know, on October 31st, there could be something pretty catastrophic.
Rosalind, this seems to be, this keeps reminding me of that scene in The Crown, where the Queen looks at, I forget which Prime Minister it was, but basically says that, you know, I've seen strong men like you come, basically saying I've seen Prime Ministers come and go. This seems to be the political scandal that she was referring to, that just kind of eats prime ministers alive. Right. David Cameron gambled on it, lost his job. Theresa May came in and said, I can get this done, lost her job. Boris Johnson comes in. Now he's before the Supreme Court. It's like this was designed to, almost to break Parliament.
Well, he certainly has already said that if the High Court came back and said that his desire to dissolve Parliament until October 15th was illegal, he's already said he will do it again. Which means he's going to be right back before someone's high court and then ultimately back before the Supreme Court. And as Peter said, Halloween, it could be catastrophic for the British economy.
And it's, go back before the Queen saying, hey, could you do this one more time for me?
Right. And now with the questions about whether he went to her on under false pretenses, well, do you really want to speak to the Queen with that hanging over your head? But, you know, more seriously, the Irish Taoiseach, or Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, has already said that while he is in New York this coming week for the UN General Assembly, he hopes to pull Johnson aside so that he can try to negotiate some way of not having a hard Brexit affect his country in a negative way. You know, there's a fear about a physical wall going up between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and Ireland. There are fears about economic flows, intellectual flows, you know, families being able to come across the border with, you know, and see each other without any real barriers. There is a real panic. And, well, Boris, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, and the Queen does not like being pulled into political controversies.
She's supposed to stay above these controversies.
Exactly, by design. Right. And we've learned a little bit more about some of the political controversies she's been pulled into. We'll get to that near the end of the program. But I want to continue and move on to the Middle East and some stories, some other stories from other parts of the world, rather. Move on to Afghanistan, where there was a series of violent attacks this week. Dozens of people are dead, hundreds more wounded. On Tuesday, there was a suicide bombing near an election rally where Afghan President Ashraf Ghani was expected to speak. At least 26 people died. Then yesterday, a Taliban truck bomb killed at least 20 people after exploding near a hospital in southern Afghanistan. That morning, a U.S. airstrike aimed at Islamic State fighters killed 9 civilians. Now, the Taliban has been vocal about its attempts to disrupt the elections that are scheduled for next Saturday. Mm-hmm. A Taliban commander, quoted anonymously in Reuters, said, quote, "We have conveyed it to all the Afghans to stay away from their polling stations unless they would be responsible for their losses," unquote. Now, Peter, ever since the U.S. Taliban peace talks fell through 2 weeks ago, there's been this wave of violence. They're bracing themselves for more ahead of next week's election. How does all of this shake out?
Well, look, I mean, this will be the fourth presidential election since the fall of the Taliban. President Ghani is, I think, very likely to win a fairly substantial way. The turnout is likely to be low because a lot of polling stations are closed because of violence. The Taliban are clearly going to try and kill people. I mean, what this really illustrates, Josh, is that, you know, the Taliban will kill you if you vote in a democratic election. I mean, that's part of their project. They certainly will try and disrupt this. But I think it, you know, I hope that it underlines their real nature for the Afghan people. I think it will.
Natan, do you get a sense of how the peace talks, the U.S. Taliban peace talks, or the collapse talks may play into all of this?
Well, for a while at least, the focus was on these talks with the Taliban, while all the time the Taliban is carrying out these attacks. I mean, there's a staggering number of more than 1,300 civilians killed in the past 6 months. So definitely this was going on all the time. But the focus was on the talks that Ambassador Khalilzad was conducting with the Taliban. Now that these talks are over, and as President Trump said, the whole negotiation is dead and it's never going to come back again, it does kind of change the focus to Afghanistan's internal problems. Now, we know that the Afghan government wasn't that pleased with the deal that the United States was trying to reach with the Taliban. So now that that's off the table, basically, Taliban feels free to do whatever they want, and the Afghan people will have to choose how they want their politics to go ahead from now.
We did want to make some time before our time is up to talk about this global climate strike, the first of two that are planned this month, kicked off today. Millions of students plan to walk out of their classrooms, with millions of adults joining them. Some of the first protests were in Australia. Reportedly, more than 300,000 people took to the streets in more than 100 cities across Australia. Businesses are protesting. Ben & Jerry's will close for part of the day. Websites like Injure will go dark. In the lead up to this, Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swedish activist who inspired today's protest, testified before Congress this week, and I loved what she had to say.
I have not come to offer any prepared remarks at this hearing. I'm instead attaching my testimony. It is the IPCC Special Report on Global Warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, the SR 1.5, which was released on October 8th, 2018. I am submitting this report as my testimony because I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists. And I want you to unite behind the science. And then I want you to take real action.
That was Greta Thunberg testifying before Congress this week. I wonder what our sense is of the impact that this global climate strike might have. There's quite a broad scope of the protest. We're bracing for some serious protests in D.C. both this weekend and on Monday. Plenty of protesters in New York. But, Natan, does this make a difference, or is this just a day for us to feel good because we took to the streets?
I don't think we can ignore the magnitude of these protests. I mean, the fact of the matter is that millions of people around the world are going out to have their voice heard. It reminds me a little bit of the gun control demonstrations that also came from the youth after Parkland. And if we go back to that example, did they have an impact? A little bit, but they didn't really change policy. I think it's more important to look at the fact that this is resonating with businesses, maybe not with governments, but with businesses. The fact that Amazon, in a kind of a preemptive move, tried to say that they'll be carbon neutral in several years. The fact that other businesses are allowing, especially big tech companies, are allowing their workers and encouraging their workers to join in. Maybe that would be the change. I don't see it changing policy, definitely not in the White House right now, but I don't think we should ignore it.
And Peter, it's fascinating that young people around the world have made such strides with this. Not surprising, because I think social media has made it easier for young people to coalesce. Young people have driven pretty much every social justice movement in human history, really. But I wonder if we see the same kind of responses to young people in the US that we see in the UK, that we see in various other parts of the world, who may or may not be as much on board about doing something about climate change.
Well, they're the people who are going to have to live with extreme climate change and extreme climate. One thing that fascinates me is President Trump has said a number of things about climate change, including initially in 2012, simply denying it's happening. What I'm puzzled by is he could say, look, I don't believe the science that it's caused by human activity, even though the consensus is overwhelming. But he could say, look, this is happening. And I'm concerned about Manhattan, which is going to have, you know, face storm surges of significant size in the next 20, 30 years. I'm concerned about southern Florida, where I also live, where, you know, the sea rise is going to be 2 feet by 2060 in Palm Beach. But instead, he sort of ignored it completely. And so even if you don't accept the science, which is, you know, would be unusual, you could still say, I believe this is happening. We should do infrastructure to basically mitigate this. But he hasn't done that.
Right. Owning a resort on a barrier island on the Atlantic Ocean that he has a responsibility to protect by the town of Palm Beach because it's a historic structure. Rosalind, I wonder, with regard to that, politically, do we see politicos around the world joining in on this? I mean, New York City public schools are letting kids protest today, with letting it be an excused absence. But are there other political leaders around the world who are signing on, or is it just kind of the voice of the people?
Well, Germany on Friday has put out a new effort to make certain that it goes zero emissions in the next 12 years or so, you know, trying to make that target date of 2030. The Climate Action Summit, which is being sponsored by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Monday, is only going to let those countries, those companies on the stage with detailed plans on how they're going to cut their reliance on fossil fuels. He has explicitly said several times in recent months, I'm not letting anyone come up just to say something, as Natan said, just for a feel-good moment. I actually want to see what is your plan to, you know, say, convert your official government fleet from gasoline to electric. What are you doing to make your buildings, you know, meet zero emission standards? How are you changing the way that you produce it, you know, your goods? This is something that he's very serious about, because there is a growing, I don't want to say panic, but it's getting there, that if something isn't done in the next 12 years, we may see a real loss of life.
One last story to tell you about. We mentioned that the Queen does not like getting pulled into political matters.
No.
Well, former Prime Minister David Cameron says he asked the Queen if she could, in his words, raise an eyebrow during the 2014 Scottish independence referendum. That request was soon followed by Queen Elizabeth making a rare public comment on British politics. At the time, Cameron was worried about what it would mean for Scotland to leave the UK. He asked the Queen's private secretary for help before the vote, and I'm quoting from the BBC documentary, "Just a raising of the eyebrow, even, you know, a quarter of an inch, we thought would make a difference," he said. A Buckingham Palace source told the BBC that the former prime minister's comments prompted an amount of displeasure. Rosalind Jordan, State and Specials Correspondent for Al Jazeera. We are very pleased to have had you here. Thank you, Rosalind.
My honor.
Always pleased to have Natan Gutman, Washington Correspondent from Israeli Public TV. Thanks, Natan.
Thank you.
And Peter Bergen, CNN National Security Analyst and the author of The United States of Jihad. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Josh.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.